Drinks much at base, he noted, already thinking he needed to find a way to bring a case of Paradise Pale Ale back to the team. Forget the drinks. Women, Pete announced quietly. There are women here, not just this bar. The whole area of southern Lemuria the hamsters moved us to. Oh, yeah. Women were the first thing Dave noticed when he walked into the bar. Clusters of women sitting at tables, with a much larger number of men trying to catch their eyes, but not approaching unless invited. With far too many men seeking far too few women, any guy who acted like a jerk had zero chance. When Dave came into the bar, he had been surrounded by people eager to hear about his role in the war game, the difference between Ruhar's skin suits and Kristang rigid armor, and what it was like to kick hamster ass, even if it had only been a game. Dave was happy to boast about his recent adventure, but he had been disappointed that few of the women seemed interested in hearing his stories, and he had not been able to speak one-on-one with any women. Up at base, there are just the six of you? Pete asked, and Dave nodded. The last time we talked, Jesse was with Shauna, and the two pilots were hooking up? It's more serious than hooking up. Dave was uncomfortable discussing the subject. Whatever. My point is that leaves you with the colonel as the only unattached woman on your team, and that's never going to happen, right? It's great that you're loyal to your team, and you guys have saved our asses down here twice. But you can't count on that happening forever, you know? You need to think about yourself. Listen, Lester and I are thinking of expanding, brewing a sort of beer for the Ruhar. We've got the facilities now, and the human market is small. But more hamsters are arriving on this dirt ball every day, and they need something to drink other than water. You're a hard worker, you're cool under pressure, and you're a genuine hero to the hamsters here. Pete lightly punched Dave's shoulder to emphasize his point. Make that work for you. I'm serious. The Paradise economy is growing, and there are opportunities out there, but you've got to act quickly, because some other guy is hustling for the same break. You'll think about it? Yeah, Dave agreed while tipping back a bottle to drink, though his attention was on a table of five women who were ignoring him and all the men around him. Two of the women were visibly pregnant, a sight Dave still found startling. He knew that women having babies was a good sign, an indication that humans were optimistic about their future on Paradise. Now think about it. Chapter 7 Best behavior, Derek whispered as he wiped a clean rag over the co-pilot armrests in the cockpit of their shiny new Dodo dropship, for which they had just received their type rating to fly. Best behavior, he insisted. You're worried about me? Irene replied innocently. I'm a model of politeness. Yes, sweetheart, Derek tapped the pilot's head. You are the model for what not to do. It won't be my fault if this jerk, this... Honored guest, Derek said slowly and patiently for emphasis as he squeezed her shoulder and made her look up at him. Irene, I'm serious. This guy is going to bait us, insult us, make cracks about how primitive we are. We can't take the bait. That's easy for you to say. I'll be doing the flying. That's because the hamster asked for you. You're the hero who flew a stolen buzzard around with a portable drill rig and destroyed a lizard battle group. All I did was get shot down and carry my pilot across the countryside. Look, this guy asking for you is a form of praise. Like Colonel Perkins said, it's an opportunity to make a good impression, but it's also a danger that we will screw up and give the hamsters an excuse to bounce us off this mission. I'm not worried one bit about your flying us up to the ship. I'm concerned your mouth might get us in trouble. Take my grandmother's advice. You can be as rude as you want. As long as you act polite. Got it? Irene squeezed his hand. I'll be on my best behavior. But after this flight, you're taking me to the gym on that cruiser and I'm hitting the punching bag hard. Ask the spirit. And don't worry, I got your back. If this hamster is really a jerk, I'll take him out back, beat the shit out of him. If anyone gives him a beatdown, it will be me. Oh, crap. Here's the asshole now. She announced as she plastered a smile on her face. You will hear a lot of noise and experience some vibration. I will be performing a run-up to test that the engines are capable of delivering max power for takeoff, Irene explained, forcing the smile to remain rigid on her face. The dropship's engines put out so much thrust that the ship would rocket down the runway, dragging its skids along the ground, so the engines had a special run-up mode where the turbine blades flattened in their housing and churned the air without providing much thrust.
Do what you need to, please.
The Ruhar government bureaucrat Arnu Charl put on a grin he intended the lowly human to see was false, as a sign of his discomfort having to trust a primitive creature with his life.
I am most concerned about your ability to safely operate this very sophisticated airspace craft. I know the air control system can remotely override your commands if you get us into trouble, but...
He flashed another intentionally thin smile.
That would be unfortunate. I should adjust this seat.
Charles scrunched his neck down as if he had trouble seeing out the forward window displays.
We Ruhar are, of course, much taller than the average human. I mean no insult, of course,
he added to ensure the pilot understood his intended insult. Irene knew Derek had already adjusted the co-pilot seat down to fit the Ruhar, who was in fact taller than most humans. So she ignored the hamster's attempt to bait her, and she didn't even need to bite her lip to stifle a sharp reply. Officially, Arnu Charl was riding with them only to observe the primitive humans in action. Unofficially, everyone knew he was looking for an excuse to squash the whole idea of humans being aboard a Ruhar ship, even an old training ship. In a minute, Irene would be taking the Dodo off the ground and up into low orbit to rendezvous with a cruiser. When she was flying, in command of the supremely powerful dropship, she could ignore anything. While she adjusted the controls to begin running up the engines at first only to 70%, she could see in her peripheral vision the hamster was reaching down under the seat with both hands, with his eyes watching the engine power levels on the co-pilot display. She nudged the throttles forward to only 12% power, making sure the turbine fan blades were indeed feathered. Then, when she was satisfied everything was operating perfectly, she advanced the throttles slowly and smoothly toward the preset 70% limit. To her right, the hamster grunted as he bent down to reach the seat controls, fumbling around under the seat bottom.
"Sir, be careful," she warned.
"The ergonomic controls for the seat are on the right side, not under..."
"No!"
Irene shouted in panic, as with her left hand she hit the master switch to kill power, and her right hand reached across to grab the Ruhar's arm. With her seat harness properly tightened, she couldn't reach across the gap, so she was unable to prevent the disaster that followed. The cockpit seat ejection mechanism in a Dodo was different from the arrangement on the truly huge dropship humans called a whale. It was the same as the system aboard the small Vulture gunships. The idiot civilian had unintentionally tugged on the ejection handle in his search for the controls to lower the already low seat, and fortunately for him, Irene, and Derek, he had not first flipped the manual switch to allow the handle to move. And anyway, Irene had not yet armed the ejection system. If he had successfully engaged the ejection sequence, the system would have accepted his command, rather than first wondering why in the hell some idiot wanted to eject from a perfectly good airspace craft that was still sitting on the ground. Afterward, the AI aboard the Dodo would have puzzled over why the ejection system had been engaged, but generations of Ruhar pilots had demanded full control over ejection, so the AI was not allowed to intervene. Engaging the ejection mechanism would have caused the cockpit door to slam violently closed. Then the sturdy brackets that connected the cockpit to the airframe would have been burned through instantly by nanocord that flashed into plasma. With the cockpit section free of the remainder of the Dodo, it would have rocketed upward and away, climbing well clear of the doomed ship that might be in danger of exploding. Eventually, when the onboard AI determined it was safe, the rocket thrust would cut off, and a nanofiber parachute would be deployed with the AI warping the fabric to steer the cockpit to a relatively safe landing. Irene and the Ruhar would be alive, though likely injured from the sudden jolt of the rocket's firing. Fortunately, none of that happened, because the Ruhar had not been trained how to use the ejection mechanism, because the designers of the system had idiot-proofed it as best they could, and because Irene, as pilot in command, had not armed the system at all. Unfortunately, there was another reason why the idiot hamster had not yanked upward on the ejection handle. His fumbling hands had found another handle that was just as dangerous.
"Derek!"
Irene screamed as she watched in terror what was happening to the co-pilot seat. Somehow the Ruhar had located and pulled the handle for the inflatable life raft tucked under the seat cushion, and that raft was now expanding at an impressive rate, forcing the seat upward and threatening to crush the hamster against the cockpit ceiling. Without thinking, Irene pounded her seat harness release button with her left fist and reached down into her right boot for a survival knife strapped there. With knife in hand, she began frantically sawing at the raft material, but it was a smart nanofabric and sealed itself rapidly behind the blade. In desperation, she began pushing the knife blade sideways, creating a larger rent, and argon gas hissed out under high pressure, blasting her in the face and forcing her eyes almost closed. At a fearful yelp from the Ruhar, who was trying and failing to release the straps holding into the seat that was now a death trap, she looked up into his pleading eyes.
Derek!
Got it, the co-pilot replied, unseen below her field of vision as the cockpit swirled with dust kicked up by the blast of argon gas coming from the inflation canister of the raft.
Okay, stopped it!
Derek exulted as his questing fingers located the tab to deflate the raft. They had practiced how to inflate and deflate a raft in training, but that course had never covered the possibility of deflating a raft when it wasn't yet fully deployed. The raft designers had never considered that possibility either. Their well-founded assumption had been that anyone wanting a raft needed it to be inflated now, as soon as possible, and that no one would ever change their freaking minds in the middle of the process. In fact, all Derek did was yank open a panel on the side of the raft to let the expanding inert gas out. But the canister was still releasing more of the stored argon, and the raft was filling faster than gas could come out the rather small flap. What saved the Ruhar's life was a combination of Derek opening the flap, Irene's knife creating a hole that required nanobots to rush there to seal the rip, and the raft's fabric getting caught on the underseat mechanism that snagged and tore more rents in the fabric. Between those three sources of tears in the fabric, the raft began to sag, and within seconds collapsed as the argon supply was exhausted. At the point, the Ruhar, who had nearly had his neck snapped by being forced against the cockpit ceiling, yelped again because the seat lurched down and forward. The force of the raft inflating had broken the brackets under the seat, snapping it free of the floor, and it fell and sagged forward, bashing Charles' face against the instrument panel.
Help!
He called as the significant weight of the seat itself had him trapped, his furry nose squashed against a display screen.
Irene, Derek grunted as he stood up and tried to lever the heavy broken seat backward. I could use some help here.
Irene stuffed the knife back in her boot before she stood up. The last thing they needed was another hazard cluttering up the cockpit floor that was already covered with billowing raft fabric and jagged broken bits of the seat attachment mechanism. With the two humans pulling and the Ruhar pushing as best he could, they got the seat awkwardly pulled back far enough so Irene could reach around with one hand and release the seat straps. Freed from the seat, the Ruhar lost no time in squeezing between the seat and instrument panel, rolling onto the floor in an undignified manner. Blood streamed down from his nose, and he moved his head stiffly, holding it to one side.
"Is your neck stiff?" Irene asked with genuine concern. "Here. Let me take off your helmet. The weight can't be good for your neck."
With the helmet off, the Ruhar gingerly moved his head side to side and back and forth, testing what range of motion he had.
"Nothing broken," he announced with a glare toward Irene,
and her mouth went dry as she imagined what the Ruhar would say to the accident investigation team. Somehow, the almost fatal incident was going to be her fault, and in a way she agreed with that conclusion. She was in command of the aircraft, so anything that happened aboard was her responsibility. Charles was going to say she should have warned him not to pull the handle to inflate the raft, as if she had ever imagined anyone would or even could be that incredibly stupid. As suddenly as the Ruhar's intense glare bored into her, that expression was replaced by what Irene knew was sheepish embarrassment, unmistakable, even though the body language was on an alien face.
"We could, keep this to ourselves, I hope," the Ruhar asked, laughing nervously.
Irene looked around the disarray in the cockpit, at the torn fabric of the raft, the snapped and twisted pieces that had secured the seat to the floor, and the smear of blood on the display screen. The Dodo would need to be taken off the flight line and back to a hangar to have the seat replaced and the airframe inspected for damage. No way could anyone conceal the incident. And then she realized something. Ruhar flight recorders captured everything that happened in a cockpit, voice, video, and sensor data. That recorder would show the accident investigators that she warned the Ruhan not to screw around under the seat, but he had ignored her. Greatly relieved, she stepped backward through the cockpit door, waving the Ruhar to follow her and offering a hand so he didn't trip over broken parts littering the floor.
"Sir, what matters is that you are not injured, that we can see. You should be examined by base medical personnel to assure you do not have internal injuries."
"Ha ha ha!" Charles swallowed hard, knowing he was going to be in big trouble.
"Thank you, Irene. Derek," he pronounced their names slowly. "I will see that you are assigned another airspace craft. Your quick reaction to the..."
He searched for a word that would not further embarrass himself.
"Unexpected incident is much appreciated. You have demonstrated your skill and mastery of this craft. I do not need to accompany you up to the ship."
He gave her a weak and sheepish smile. Then he waggled a finger accusingly.
"That raft should not be capable of being inflated while it is still attached to the seat. I must speak with the manufacturer of that system."
"I agree completely, sir," Irene nodded with sympathy. "What if the system deployed on its own and caused the pilots to lose control? Battle damage might also cause the raft to inflate at the wrong time. We will add a note to that effect in our squawk list, sir."
An hour later, with the Ruhar at the base hospital and the Dodo having been towed back to a hangar, Irene was filling out accident report forms on a tablet while she talked with Perkins via Z-phone.
"Yes, ma'am, I think that Ruhar is going to be just fine. His pride is hurt more than anything. The hamster..."
She caught herself from using the derogatory slang while in earshot of aliens at the airbase.
"Ruhar here are anxious to get us away. Derek is on the flight line checking out our replacement ship now."
"The ship you were supposed to fly. Is it damaged badly?" Perkins asked anxiously.
A minor incident could be mostly swept under the rug with the airbase maintenance team quietly replacing broken parts. But if the airframe had sustained damage and the dropship needed to be pulled out of service for an extended time, the incident could cause a big stink that Senior Ruhar would be eager to blame on ignorant humans who should not be allowed to fly in the first place.
"No, ma'am," Irene reported happily. "The crew chief told me this is the damnedest thing he's ever seen in all his years, and he didn't think it was possible for a raft to inflate while still under a seat. This may lead to a new safety regulation."
"Great, as long as nobody ever says we humans are the cause of needing to idiot-proof something. I think all the Ruhar here at the base would very much like to pretend this never happened. Soon as these forms are completed, I'll help Derek pre-flight our new bird, and we should be up there with only a 7-hour delay."
7 hours? Perkins asked, surprised and dismayed.
"Yes, ma'am. The cruiser's orbit has taken it away from us, so our next good launch window is not for a couple hours," Irene explained patiently.
"God damn it," Perkins cursed with exasperation. "Why isn't the future like Star Trek, where you never have to think about the reality of orbital mechanics?"
"I'll get right on that, Colonel," Irene laughed.
"Can you launch now? I don't give a shit about your fuel consumption."
"We could, yes. It's not normal procedure," Irene started to explain.
"To hell with normal procedure, then," Perkins cut off her pilot's explanation.
"Tell them you are practicing combat rendezvous maneuvers, whatever bullshit you want to call it. I'll get it cleared with the air controller. I want you in the air ASAP, before the hamsters change their minds or some higher-ups decide they need a full investigation. That cruiser is not waiting for us. It will be leaving whether we're on it or not."
"Yes, ma'am," Irene agreed with enthusiasm.
"Strebich," Perkins' voice softened. "We dodged a bullet today. If that Ruhar had been seriously injured or killed, the hamsters wouldn't care that it was his own stupid fault."
"You're right, Colonel. He could have been killed. A couple more seconds."
She didn't need to finish the thought. Right before Derek had ripped open the tab to deflate the raft, the Ruhar had been pressed up against the ceiling, his neck at an awkward angle. Irene had feared her passenger was already dead at that point. Of all the crazy, stupid things that had happened during her flying career, someone inflating a raft inside the cockpit was beyond not only her experience, it had been beyond her imagination.
"Win ugly?" she suggested.
"Win ugly?"
"All right," Perkins sighed from the heavy weight of responsibility.
"I guess you can't argue with getting one in the W column. Damn it.
If anything goes wrong out there, we are not getting a pass from our patrons. We all understand that, Colonel. We are all doing our best. That's not good enough. I don't mean to be a hard-ass, Strebitch, but we need to consider not only what will go wrong, but what could go wrong. Irene didn't think she would ever have considered a life raft to be anything that could be a threat, but she didn't want to argue right then. Captain Bonsu and I still have 3 combat traps each to perform after we get back from the cruiser, ma'am. Traps? Derek gave Irene the side-eye because she used pilot slang too often around non-pilots. Flying a dropship into a docking bay, Irene gestured the action with her hands, until it is caught, or trapped, by the emergency restraint system. We need to perform 3 traps at high speed to qualify for spaceflight duty. There's where our focus needs to be right now. Understood. You did well, Strebitch. You and Bonsu. I'll see if I can smuggle some debriefing fluid upstairs with me, so we can celebrate when the 2 of you are carrier qualified.
Are you nervous, Captain? Jesse asked, noting the pilot had been tugging at a lock of her hair as she studied whatever was on her tablet. Flying up to the cruiser should be a piece of cake for you, right? It's no different from you docking with one of those practice platforms in orbit like you've been doing.
Thanks, Jess. Sergeant Coulter. She had been about to use the first names they'd gotten used to during their unauthorized and informal service together, but switched to military protocol when she caught Perkins with the corner of one eye. It is different. Those big docking platforms don't have real-life people aboard who could get hurt if we screw up, and they're designed to get bumped into. The cruiser is not. The real problem is for us to get carrier qualified. She used the U.S. Navy term rather than its awkward Ruhar equivalent. We each have to get 3 successful combat traps in a dodo, unassisted.
Combat traps, ma'am? Jesse asked, confused.
Irene used one hand to illustrate a dropship coming into a starship's docking bay. Usually, docking procedures are done slow and careful, hands off. We fly close to the ship, and the docking bay's control system takes over, flies us into the bay nice and easy. That's what happened on our first flight up to the cruiser 2 days ago. If the docking bay system can't sync with our onboard AI, the AI can fly us in by itself, but that leaves a single point of failure. So we also practice manual docking. A dodo dropship isn't huge like a whale transport, but those docking bay door openings look awful tiny when you're approaching. We practiced the manual procedure for docking while we were up there.
I can imagine that, Jesse agreed. But again, you've done that already.
What we haven't done yet is manual combat traps. In action, a starship wants to recover birds quick as possible so they can jump away. Again, usually we rely on automated systems, but you can't always count on them working in combat. So Captain Bonsu and I have to fly a high-speed approach into a docking bay. If we miss or fly in too far... She smacked one hand into the other.
You want us to fly up there first, put a tennis ball on a string from the ceiling of the docking bay so you know how far to pull in?
Dave suggested jokingly.
That would be great, Chaika.
Irene tilted her head and frowned at Dave.
Well, that tennis ball trick works great to park a minivan in a garage.
But we'll be flying a dropship the size of a Boeing 777 airliner coming in at 400 feet per second. Just to approach, we have to shoot through a tiny gap in the ship's energy shield, and there will be simulated explosions going off to distract us because that's what happens in real combat. As a bonus, some of the flight systems will be disabled or will drop offline as we approach.
Hell, Captain, that... Sounds dangerous, Jesse observed, his face turning pale.
Nothing bad can really happen. Unless we royally screw up. The control system will take over if we're going to crash, but we don't want that to happen. This first time we will get 5 attempts to dock, and we need 3 successful traps out of 5. They're going easy on us because we only had a month of training. When we get out there, she gestured toward the sky and beyond, they'll be running us through exercises continuously, and eventually we'll need to hit the mark successfully every time, or they'll wash us out.
If our pilots wash out, we go with them, Perkins warned.
The Ruhar view the Mavericks as a team. They're not splitting us up. No other unit wants just the 4 of us soldiers as a spaceborne infantry team.
All for one, ma'am, Shauna suggested.
And one for all, Perkins finished the saying. The only good news I know of is this cruiser will have a bunch of flight cadets who will be burning eager to show they can do whatever experienced human pilots, she pointed to Irene and Derek, can't do. I expect some of those nuggets to crash and burn, and that will give us breathing room for a couple minor slip-ups, if we don't crash a dropship or lose someone at an airlock.
Yeah, Dave, Jesse winked at his friend.
Me?
Dave asked defensively.
What are you looking at me for? I figure if one of us gets blowed out an airlock by mistake, it ain't gonna be me.
Jesse winked to Shauna.
Hey,
Dave thumped his chest.
When we were in Kachako,
he meant the city in Nigeria,
I'm not the one who fell out the window of that cat house.
Whoa!
Jesse waved his hands frantically.
Nobody needs to hear that sordid tale right this minute.
Cat house? Shauna asked, arms rigidly folded across her chest.
Like a brothel?
Yeah, we were just searching the place for insurgents.
Jesse shot a pleading look to his comrade in arms.
And we actually were, Dave admitted.
When Shauna gave him a skeptical look, he folded like a rug.
Well, we did find insurgents there, kinda unintentionally. It was Bishop's idea. That's when Pone went out the window.
That guy had an AK, Jesse explained. It was either I go out the window or get an ass full of 7.62 rounds. Anyways,
he wanted to avoid discussing that subject any further.
Let's not talk about that now. Captain Strebich, Bonsu, best of luck to you going up to the, what's that ship's name again?
It's the Rue Tostella, Derek explained.
Tostella? Dave laughed. And what are the odds we won't call it the toaster?
Even Perkins had to chuckle at that remark.
Just don't call it that when the hamsters can hear you. I don't think they go for giving nicknames to their ships.
Now that your team has qualified for spaceborne duty, HQ has a going-away present for you.
Bezenson picked a bag off the floor and took 6 mugs out, setting them on the table.
The Ruha cranked these out for us. The logo is our idea.
Perkins picked up a mug. It was solid, like a ceramic coffee mug, but lighter than styrofoam, and the handle folded so mugs could be stacked. Printed into the olive drab exterior was a logo Perkins had not seen before. It read X-Force on top, with any time, anywhere, any fight below. A yellow star with a swoosh separated the 2 lines of text.
Ma'am, this kind of looks like a logo for a minor league hockey team.
Bezenson laughed at that.
HQ is not exactly stuffed with marketing experts. This is what the Big 5 could agree on.
Before the expeditionary force left Earth, there had been attempts to agree on a single motto, but talks had fallen apart, and mottos were not considered a priority, so each of the 5 nations had their own logo and motto. The U.S. military's contribution for an official motto was Taking the Fight to the Stars, which was universally agreed to be totally lame, but no worse than the mottos of the other 4 nations. Naturally, the troops came up with their own mottos, especially after the force realized their task would be peacekeeping on Paradise. Rent-a-grunts was one unofficial motto, along with Mall Cops to the Stars and We'll Work for Food. Bezenson thought that last one was entirely appropriate.
HQ wanted something that sounded fierce. Perkins, this, she tapped a mug, is for a morale booster here on Paradise.
Perkins looked at the mug with skepticism.
Anytime, anywhere, sure, but any fight?
Well, because we never know what crazy shit we'll get into next, and we won't back down.
Bezenson was pleased to see Perkins nod determined agreement.
HQ did a survey of soldiers who chose to remain in the force, and over 70% of them cited the actions of your team as a major motivator.
Your Mavericks proved humans can be useful in the war, that we might have a purpose out here beyond growing food and surviving.
Colonel, this is important. We need to give the force a mission out here, or there won't be an X-Force. We're hoping after the Mavericks come back, the hamsters will allow other teams to go off-world.
Any fight? General, with the crazy shit we've had to deal with, I think any fight is absolutely appropriate.
The yellow team commander of the war game reminded me that his people never know what planet they might be fighting on next. They don't even know whether the atmosphere will be breathable.
So yeah, any fight describes the attitude we must have.
Perkins thought Coulter and Chaika would lose their minds when they saw the coffee mugs, because in her experience, young male soldiers loved macho shit. Scratch that, she told herself. Sergeant Jarrett was totally going to love it. Probably Irene, too. Derek Bonsu was the one who might worry that having any fight as a motto was just asking for trouble. Well, what the hell? Finding trouble was why they were going to the stars anyway.
I'd like to say we'll keep in touch, but...
Yeah. Besenson stood and offered a hand to shake. Interstellar communications are spotty at best. Just make sure you come back. And come back with the hamsters seeing the value of your team.
We will do our best, ma'am, Perkins said. Then to herself added, or die trying.
Chapter 8 After Derek and Irene were declared fully qualified for flying Dodo dropships, they flew up to the toaster with Perkins, leaving the three sergeants to wrap up things dirtside and catch a big whale transport up to the ship. They were met in the docking bay by a female Ruhar cadet who was not unfriendly, but gave the impression she had way too much to do for escorting aliens around the ship. The cadet led the way, with Shauna walking on the right beside her and Jesse and Dave behind. With the ship preparing to get underway and cadets racing around under the supervision of the few adult crew members, the journey forward was slowed by having to squeeze against the side of passageways to make way for cadets on more important missions. Cadet Garner, Shauna asked after a steady stream of cadets had come around a corner. Where are the officers? They had walked a quarter of the ship's length, and all she had seen were cadets. Not only cadets hurrying past, but also cadets working at consoles, performing maintenance, and even loading practice missiles into a Vulture fighter dropship. So far, the only adults she had seen were herself and the other two human sergeants.
Please call me Jin. There are only 11 adults of my people aboard the Rue Tostella,
Jin Garner explained patiently.
On this training mission, third and fourth year cadets are supposed to perform all necessary activities, under supervision of the adult officers, of course, she added when she saw Shauna nervously gritting her teeth.
Well, that's great, Dave filled in as Shauna and Jesse shared a quick look of terror. A starship, a mind-bogglingly sophisticated piece of alien technology, was being mostly flown and maintained by children? No, not a piece of technology. A starship was a collection of millions of pieces of advanced technology, with several hundred or more of those pieces vital to safe operation of the ship.
Do not worry. I have been told there is only a small chance the ship could go boom.
Jin winked in a gesture she had been told the humans would understand.
Oh, thank, Dave began to say. Although I was told that by a third-year cadet, so he could be wrong,
Jin added with a straight face. Her performance only spoiled when she looked to see the reaction of the humans. As they came near an intersection, the cadet pointed to the right, and Shauna hugged the wall to avoid bumping into anyone coming around the corner. Just as she reached the intersection and turned right, Shauna came face to face with a Kristang. Instincts took over, and Shauna shouted while slamming her right shoulder into the lizard's midsection. With the heel of her left hand, she punched the alien hard in the chest once, twice. Then the Kristang was falling down, and Shauna was being pulled backwards. Cadet Garner had both hands on Shauna's shoulders and was pulling her down, shouting something like, "No, friend!
Easy, easy, baby!"
Jesse held Shauna so she didn't crack her head on the floor, and Dave leaped up and around the falling woman to stand between her and the lizard. Jesse moved to spin Shauna so she would be behind him, but she resisted, and they tussled for a second.
"Halt! Stop!" the cadet ordered frantically. "She is a friend!"
Dave did not waver from a fighting stance as the Kristang pushed itself off the floor, stood up, and smoothed the front of its shirt.
"This is the first time I have met humans."
The lizard smiled in a horrible grimace and made a short bow. It rubbed its chest.
"You hit harder than I expected. Perhaps your species is not as weak as I was told."
Then, impulsively, it stuck out a hand toward Dave. Dave stood stiffly until the cadet, frantic head jerking, urged him to return the gesture of friendship. Warily, Dave came out of a crouch and took the lizard's hand, which was warm and dry. Dave did not want the lizard to feel a limp, dead fish grip, but he also didn't want the creature to interpret a hard squeeze as a threat. The lizard squeezed back with the same firm pressure, then released before it became awkward. Then the Kristang nodded to the Ruhar cadet and continued on along the hallway, turning around a corner out of sight. Jesse let out the breath he had been holding.
"Can someone please tell me just what the hell that was?"
"Velt Sir Kotra Tutula is not the Kristang you know."
Jin had stepped back from the three humans, disturbed by the incident.
"She is Verd Kris. Velt is her rank in their system. I do not know its equivalent in the UNEF military."
"She?" Jesse gasped. "That was a female? I thought they were all weak and small and..." Realizing he was talking to two females who might not appreciate having their gender spoken of in those terms. "Well, because, you know, the warrior caste genetically engineered them like that, which is a bad thing, a terrible thing." He decided the best thing to do right then was to stop talking.
"The name Verd Kris means true Kristang, or original Kristang, or first Kristang. Something like that," Jin explained. "They are from a population of Kristang cut off from their society when a wormhole shift blocked access to their home territory. My people then took control of the territory, but we did not wish to expend the effort to take that planet. All we did was remove their capability for faster-than-light spaceflight to protect ourselves. Over 800 years, Verd Kris society drifted away from the distorted culture enforced by the warrior caste, and back toward the matriarchal culture of the Kristang before the Therannan conquered their homeworld long ago. Some Verd Kris now fight alongside my people, and they are extremely fierce warriors, especially their women."
"Goddamn." Jesse let his shoulder slump with a shudder, coming down off an adrenaline high.
"Why didn't someone tell us?" Shauna asked as she rubbed her sore left hand, getting right in the cadet's face.
The well-disciplined cadet did not flinch.
"We thought you knew. That information was not in the briefing packet about the ship?"
"Info that friendly lizards were aboard the toaster?" Shauna asked with angry sarcasm. "No, we were not told that."
"God damn," Jesse repeated. "Hell, I would have remembered that. You okay, hun? Shauna?" Shauna shot Jesse a look that told him calling her honey in public was not acceptable.
"We know about the Verd Kris a little. I heard a rumor some of them have been on Paradise, Gitanu, but I've never met one. Or seen one."
"I do not know whether any Verd Kris have been on Gitanu."
Jin bit her lower lip.
"There is one other Verd Kris aboard. You will meet him later today during the orientation briefing. He has met humans on our capital world when your liaison people were there after the Maser Cannon incident. The other Verd Kris is..."
She thought carefully, not entirely willing to trust the translator.
"Interesting."
"Interesting how?" Shauna asked with a look to Jesse.
"You will see. He is a Sergon, a rank similar to a sergeant or warrant officer in your human military. His training methods can be somewhat rough and profane. Do not be alarmed. He is on our side."
"Are you sure about that?" Jesse suppressed a shudder at the unexpected encounter with just one of the lizard-like aliens. He lowered his voice and looked both ways in the passageway they were walking along.
"You trust a Kristang? I mean, Verd Kris?" he added with a cringe.
"Do not be embarrassed. They are Kristang, by origin. Over the years, the two societies have drifted apart genetically because of isolation from each other, and because the Verd Kris have pursued genetic modifications different from their hostile cousins."
She paused, cocking her head.
"Did that translate properly? I used a term for family who are not directly related."
"Yeah, cousins is good," Jesse assured her.
"The most obvious difference, of course, can be seen in Verd Kris females. Their genetics have been restored close to the original baseline, before the Maxalks, through the Therannan, forced changes on their society."
Shauna flexed her sore wrist.
"What happened?"
"What happened to the Kristang
is what happened to every species under the Maxalks coalition, Jin shrugged. When the Thuranen made contact with the Kristang, the lizards had spaceflight capability. They had established a colony on another planet in their star system, and they had an extensive operation to mine asteroids. Their scientists had not yet discovered the theoretical basis for the jump drive, so they did not have starflight. They still do not truly have the ability to travel between stars, she added with a smug wink. Nor do their ships have artificial gravity as our ships do, as you know.
Yeah. Jesse bounced on his toes, assuring himself the artificial gravity aboard the Ruhar ship felt just like real gravity on a planet. Except for an odd sensation of being tugged into two directions when he crossed the gap from one gravity plate to another, the effect was not noticeably the result of any technology.
And we appreciate that. I hated the zero-G on the Kristang ships that brought us to paradise.
How did the Thuranen make contact with the Kristang? Shauna asked.
The usual way, like the situation with your people. The Kristang homeworld was isolated for millions of years, then a wormhole shift provided easy access for the Thuranen. That region of space was not of any strategic importance to the Thuranen, but they were eager to match their Bosphorak rivals by acquiring a client species.
Did you know the Thuranen used to be clients of the Bosphorak?
It's true, though the Thuranen hate to admit it. When the Thuranen arrived at the Kristang homeworld, they followed the Maxalt's process for conquering a species and turning them into clients. They studied Kristang society and selected the most fanatical, oppressive group to put in charge. For the Kristang, that was the warrior caste.
Wait, the warrior caste was not already in power?
No. Sergeant Jarrett, please call me Shauna.
She did not know if that was correct protocol, but the cadet had been friendly and seemed to want to use first names.
Yes, Shauna.
Jin flashed a smile.
Before the Thuranen arrived, Kristang society was splintered between clans, and they certainly were not a peaceful species. But they had avoided suffering a wide-scale nuclear war and were evolving toward a stable coexistence between clans. Each clan had a warrior caste that was a small group, perhaps 3 to 4% of the overall population. The Kristang were a matriarchal society. Females led the clans. The warrior caste in some clans had long wished to assume power and strike the other clans, so when the Thuranen arrived, they flipped their clients' society upside down and put the warrior caste in power. The stated excuse was that the warrior caste needed to take charge to prepare the Kristang for battle against my people, or the Torgala.
You were planning an attack?
No. Jin shook her head sadly. We knew almost nothing about the Kristang, and had no interest in them. Their home system is far from our territory, especially back then. Our experience with the Kristang, how we passively stood by and did nothing while the Thuranen perverted their primitive society and turned them into a direct threat to us, is partly why we struck your homeworld. Your world is too far away for my people to maintain a presence there. Even now, after the Jarraptha have captured 12% of Thuranen territory in their recent offensive, Earth is too far away for us. The purpose of our raid on your world was to deny the easy use of your industrial base to the Kristang.
Shauna forced herself not to say anything. She nodded for Jin to continue.
We knew that Earth is remote and not strategically important to the Kristang. Our hope was that if the Kristang saw they could not easily use your world as a staging base, they would lose interest in humans. That did partly happen. Their White Wind clan nearly drove themselves into bankruptcy through their effort to conquer Earth.
The cadet gave Shauna a sad smile.
Now they're stuck here.
Shauna looked straight ahead so the young Ruhar would not see the moisture in her eyes.
The Kristang at Earth, I mean. When the wormhole shut down, the Kristang at Earth became trapped.
Yes.
Shauna, I am sorry. Did that translate correctly?
Yeah, you're sorry.
Thank you.
Shauna reminded herself that everything Jin told her was the official propaganda of the Ruhar government. No,
Worse. It was that official story as told by a young, idealistic cadet who wanted to believe her people were always right and just and noble. Even though they had bombarded Earth's power generation and industrial infrastructure from orbit, killing thousands of humans in the assault or its aftermath. When they received official orders to report aboard the Ruta Estella, the data package included a layout of the ship and regulations for the crew. The Mavericks had been pleased to see the ship had three galleys, with one reserved for senior officers. Perkins learned to her dismay that she was expected to take her evening meal with the Ruhar officers and senior cadets instead of with her own team. Shauna scrolled down the data package while waiting for the all-clear to sound so they could move about the ship, and was surprised to see a section for aliens. In this case, aliens referred to any being who was not Ruhar, reminding Shauna exactly where she and her fellow humans ranked in the Ruhar military. As she read the regulations and suggestions for aliens, her frown grew deeper, and she squinted uncomfortably. "Ma'am, this ship has a quarters section set aside just for us?" "Yes," Perkins replied without looking up from her tablet. She had received a very skimpy briefing about the ship just after she accepted the assignment, so she knew some of the details ahead of time. The cruiser had a section of three cabins, one washroom, and a small common area that was reserved for her team. According to the layout, much of the ship's crew accommodation space could be reconfigured as needed, and it looked to her like partitions had been added to enclose an area just for the Mavericks. She did not know whether the separation of humans from the Ruhar crew was intended as a mild form of insult, but she was relieved to see it, as it reduced the potential for friction in the close quarters aboard the training ship. She was irritated that the Ruhar had not consulted her before setting up a separate space for humans. There were three small cabins, each with two stacked bunks and no space for squeezing in a third bunk even if she wanted that. Because the bunks doubled as acceleration couches where her people needed to be strapped in when the ship was simulating combat maneuvers, having a third person sleeping on the floor was not an option. Originally, she had considered having the three men share one cabin, with Irene and Shauna bunking together, and giving her a cabin all to herself. Ship's regs did not allow more people than bunks, and since there was no way to add a third bunk, she had to make other arrangements. Shauna could share with Jesse, while Irene and Derek could share another cabin. That left Dave Chaika as the odd man out, with Emily Perkins seeing no alternative to sharing a cabin with the young sergeant she found quite attractive, if she let herself admit feelings she could not officially have. "There are three cabins. Jarrett, you'll be with Coulter. Strebich with Bonsu." "Ma'am." Irene looked at her commanding officer as her cheeks grew red. "Strebich, whether you've made it official or not with Bonsu, I don't see the point in trying to keep you two separated." Everyone knew the two pilots were a couple, though they had attempted to be reasonably discreet about their relationship. "Yes, Colonel." Irene looked away, not believing her good fortune. She had not been looking forward to being separated from Derek during their scheduled months aboard the ship. What about me, ma'am? Dave's own face was draining of color as he imagined being stuck bunking with a Ruhar or trying to sleep in a missile tube. "Will I be hot bunking it with Coulter or something?" The thought of crashing in Jesse's bunk while the man was away from the cabin did not appeal to Dave at all. "No, you're with me, Chaika." Ma'am? Dave's question ended in almost a squeaky uptone. Perkins tilted her head in a confident gesture that covered up the butterflies in her stomach. "The Ruhar do not separate genders in their bunk assignments, and our section doesn't have separate officers' quarters. Look, people, I know this is going to be awkward, but think of it this way. We will be up there to train and live with aliens on their ship. When in Rome, do as the Romans do, you got that? We need to get used to doing things the hamster way. That includes sleeping arrangements. We might as well be on our best behavior while in our little section of the ship, which will remind us to be on our toes 24/7 among the Ruhar. Understood?" Yes, Colonel, Dave stammered. "Chaika," Perkins took pity on the extremely embarrassed sergeant. "I'm not thrilled about this either, and we need to act like it's no big deal because to the hamsters it is not an issue. We have a common area in the middle of the three cabins, so I expect to use that cabin only when I'm getting rack time, she declared, as she thought to herself that maybe she should ask the ship's executive officer whether there was any sort of private workspace she could use during the daytime hours. We're all going to be cool about the living situation. We're going to be mature about it, and we're going to show the hamsters that humans are an evolved species. Does everyone understand? Crystal clear. Jesse spoke first, nodding a bit too vigorously from the tantalizing thought that he and Shauna would have a real door to provide privacy. Yes, ma'am, Dave agreed. I expect we are all going to be ass-dragging exhausted every night anyway, Perkins added. The Ruhar have told me they do not intend to coddle us in training, so we need to keep up with a genetically superior species aboard a ship with equipment that is all new to us and second nature to them. We will be like your grandparents, she winked, trying to use smartphones. Oh, forget it, Dave groaned, and everyone laughed. That broke the tension. Perkins reinforced the lighter mood by wagging a finger at Dave. I'm warning you right now, Chaika. If you snore, I'm going to smother you with a pillow. Don't you worry, ma'am. Dave found himself actually grinning despite the still awkward circumstances. You should worry about Shauna. Jesse here snores like a chainsaw. Hey, Jesse shook a fist at Dave. Only when I get a cold or something. Right, like you had a cold the whole time we shared that hut in the jungle? Ah, I was allergic to that ugly couch, maybe. At the first opportunity for privacy, Jesse pulled Dave aside. Ski. Hey, man, you gonna be okay? Like I got a choice? I'll be sleeping in my camo uni pants and a t-shirt, I guess, he said unhappily. He thought that wearing thick, baggy pants and a shirt were the best way to make bunking together less awkward for Colonel Perkins. Maybe he could suggest they leave their cabin door open. Then he got a pensive look on his face. The Colonel's right, though. Out here we might as well throw some of the old rules out the window. I mean, not just aboard the ship. Us being military on Paradise? He touched the American flag patch on his uniform top. It's kind of crazy, you know. What does it mean for us to be U.S. Army when we're cut off from the U.S. of A? Maybe forever? I don't know, Jesse admitted. I've been thinking the same thing. Like, if we weren't doing something important up here, I might have turned in my stripes by now, you know? Really? That surprised Dave. Jesse had intended to make the military a career from the day he signed up. Bishop had been open about wanting to get out of the army and use the money for college, although at the time of Columbus Day, he still had no idea what he wanted to do with his life. And Dave? Dave wasn't sure whether he wanted to stay in or not. His time in Nigeria, where one random group after another shot at him or planted improvised bombs, and the politicians back home could not define what the mission was supposed to be, or even when or if the mission would end, had for a time soured Dave on the army. Then came Columbus Day, and it had no longer mattered what Dave's plans were. Yeah, man. Jesse's eyes darted over to where Shauna was unpacking her gear in the cabin they would share. Big things are happening on Paradise, even for us humans. People are getting out and setting up farms, setting up businesses, starting a new life, you know? We're up here showing the flag and making sure the hamsters don't forget all we did for them, but I'm getting worried that by the time we are old news and UNEF dissolves, other people will have grabbed all the good opportunities. We got to think about the future, Ski, and I don't just mean tomorrow. Has Shauna talked to you about the future? Hell no, man, Jesse whispered harshly. I haven't said a word about it. I don't want to scare her away. With human women vastly outnumbered by men on Paradise, traditional gender courtship had been flipped on its head, with women being reluctant to get rushed into a commitment and men eager to hold on to relationships. On Paradise, it was only foolish men who said those three little words, I love you, first, to avoid sounding clingy and scaring away a woman. Shauna always wanted to be infantry, and now she's got it. He shook his head. She's not going to be tempted by the idea of us putting down roots on a farmstead in the middle of nowhere, not while she's got shiny Ruhar toys to play with. And good luck to you, Pwn. Dave held out a fist and Jesse bumped it. Hey, don't worry, man. You'll find a girl soon. You're famous. Fame don't mean much these days, Dave frowned. And we're stuck on this bucket for months.
I am sure as hell not finding a girl out here.
Emily Perkins lay down to sleep on the bottom bunk, wearing pants and a t-shirt. At first, she had kept her bra on, but 10 minutes of discomfort made her decide to quietly wriggle around under the sheet and extract the bra out through one arm of her shirt, a maneuver she knew always amazed men. Another adjustment was needed. With pants on, her feet were too hot, so she kicked her feet out from under the sheet. At last, she was physically comfortable enough to fall asleep, and she certainly was tired enough from the long and eventful day. But her mind was racing, despite her effort to concentrate only on breathing slowly. After a frustrating 10 minutes of thoughts bouncing around in her head like the ball in an old pinball machine, she felt herself drifting off. Thus, she was extremely annoyed when a squeaking noise from outside the cabin intruded on her attempt to sleep. She tried flopping the pillow over her head to block out the sound, but it was no good. Finally, Perkins couldn't take it any longer. The cabin's control pad was high on the wall near the top bunk.
Chaika, you awake?
What? Dave pretended to be far more groggy than he was. His plan had been to lay awake, breathing deeply and evenly to pretend he was asleep, until he was sure Perkins had dropped off into dreamland. Only then could he hope that if he did snore, he didn't keep his commanding officer awake.
Can you hit the door controls? Close the damn thing? Is that squeaking sound keeping you awake, too? I can see if there's something caught in an air vent, he suggested.
Chaika, she sighed, and it turned into a yawn. That sound isn't coming from the ship.
Oh.
Dave rose up on one elbow.
Oh.
He could feel his face growing beet red in the darkness. And of course, right as he fumbled for the door controls and the unfamiliar alien cabin, the squeaking sounds grew closer together and louder until even the sleepiest of minds could not mistake the source of the sound. Mercifully, he found the button and the door slid closed.
Sorry about that, ma'am.
Why is it your fault?
Ma'am, in Nigeria we got into some tough spots. Jesse and I saved each other's lives more than once. Bishop, too. If I hadn't saved Cornpone back then.
He let his voice trail off in a soft chuckle.
I appreciate the thought, Chaika, but what makes you think that noise has to be from Coulter and Jared?
Sorry, ma'am.
He had not considered that Captains Strebich and Bonsu might be celebrating their first night aboard the ship.
Stop saying you're sorry, Chaika. Let's catch some shut-eye. We have a busy day tomorrow.
Yes, ma'am.
He looked at the now closed cabin door, faintly illuminated by the light of the communications panel.
Should I go crash on the couch?
Thanks for the offer, but that's against regs.
The ship's not underway, Dave stated, unsure of himself. We're still attached to the resupply platform.
The Paradise system is still a threat grade 3 combat zone. Regs state anyone intending to be on a sleep cycle must be in a certified acceleration couch in case the ship needs to move quickly.
You're anxious to get out of here?
Why, do I snore?
No, ma'am.
It's just...
He didn't bother to finish.
This is awkward for me too, Chaika. We'll be bunking together for months. Might as well get used to it now.
I suppose.
He almost added, and I'm sorry, but overrode his mouth before he could say anything.
Good night.
Good night, soldier.
No sooner had Dave let himself settle down into the bed when a different sound caught his ear. Not a sound, exactly. More like a vibration coming through the wall. A rhythmic thumping, slowly getting louder and faster.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Perkins exploded in frustration, then laughed.
That's not Jesse.
Dave found himself laughing along with the colonel. If the thumping was coming through the wall, then it had to be from the adjacent cabin shared by Irene and Derek.
All I can say is those two had damned well better be rested in the morning, Perkins complained with disgust.
Then she couldn't help laughing, and she and Dave began laughing uncontrollably together. The thumping reached a crescendo, and after 5 or 6 hard banging sounds, stopped.
Thank God for that,
Perkins gasped when she was able to stop laughing enough to catch her breath.
If they go for round 2, I'm knocking on their door, Dave said half seriously.
Let's hope they don't, she agreed. And it struck her then there was a major disadvantage to having the ship's crew quarters being reconfigurable. Instead of sturdy, fixed bulkheads, the movable partitions were thin and flimsy. Somehow, in the morning, she needed to discreetly let the two other women know just how sound transmitted through the cabin walls. Unless they already knew. How could they